Thanks. It's a pleasure to speak here today. I'd like to begin with a brief review of neutral hydrogen in our universe. As you know, at early times, the universe is hot enough that it's also fully ionized. As it cools through its expansion, you can form neutral species. These can collapse to form the first luminous objects, which in turn re-ionize the universe. In the epoch that brings us up to the present, this ionized gas can make its way back into galaxies and perhaps shield itself to become neutral and perhaps become molecular and then turn back into stars. We know a lot about recombination through the CMB. Much less is known about reionization other than that it does occur and probably proceeds in a patchy way. In the present epoch, I'd like to highlight just one aspect of neutral hydrogen, which is that in systems like this, it will glow. So again, the way you think about this is as a snapshot of the stellar fuel cycle, so as hydrogen becomes neutral and can eventually form stars. The second is that even though this is after reionization, the abundance is, the omega of H1 is 10 to the minus 3. So there's actually a fair amount to work with. And what this means is that the large-scale structure which hosts these particular objects will glow. So this is something that's very different than what people typically imagine for reionization, where the power spectrum is from the IGM. This is really from particular systems. We've heard a lot about the power of galaxy surveys and large-scale structure to constrain cosmology, and you might wonder whether you can conduct these surveys more easily in other wavelengths, or at least get complementary information, and in particular, whether you could use the 21-centimeter line. And the Alfalfa collaboration has used Arecibo to conduct a beautiful survey out to modest redshifts, where again, you see this large-scale structure. The idea here is that you pick out individual objects at high significance. So each one of those might be detected at Silvestre noise of 5. And to do that, you need a very large instrument and a sensitive receiver and to look at low redshifts. You might wonder whether you could blur this out. And this is starting to get to a question that Ben had about HETTEX. And simply look for an overabundance of matter by the light that it emits. And you can see that instead of measuring the mass function of H1, you're really measuring the integral of H1 in those volumes, which is astrophysically also pretty interesting. In this case, the smallest resolution that you need to, the resolution of your experiment is set by the smallest scale that you care about, which is the nonlinear scale that is fairly large. And second, to conduct a perfectly respectable large-scale structure survey, you can get signal to noise of 1 on a Fourier mode in this volume instead of signal to noise of 5 on each individual object. So these two things mean that it's much easier to jump to a higher redshift. And the way you can think about this is as something like a CMB survey, but in 3 dimensions. So it's diffuse emission in slices, but with huge foregrounds that we'll see soon. So let me tell you about an experiment we've undertaken with the Green Bank telescope to make a 21-centimeter intensity survey. It's a modest-sized collaboration, and our analysis has been led at CETA. Green Bank is a 100-centimeter dish. It's the largest steerable dish, and despite its size, the full-path max is 0.3 degrees, which shows some contrast with the optical. We observe with the prime focus receiver between 700 and 900 megahertz, or a redshift of 0.6 and 1. The survey geometry is a truncated pyramid that goes from 900 down to 700 megahertz in 256 spectral slices. And the way we map this is by scanning the whole telescope at constant elevation and letting the sky rotate through. And to follow that patch, we observe a range of parallactic angles, and that makes the treatment of noise a bit easier. So I think a good way to visualize these volumes is something like the way you see MRIs, that is a slice by slice through this 3D volume. This is an MRI of This is an MRI of a cantaloupe. So all the movies I'll show are something like this, where we go from 900 dropping down to 700 megahertz. Okay, the first thing you'd like to do in this sort of experiment is understand what the level of the signal is. And to do this, you can draw a Gaussian realization of the matter power spectrum. And clearly, that's not the most accurate thing, but it gives you a sense of the RMS. And you can multiply that by the brightness temperature for 21 centimeter in those overdensities, and then convolved by the instrumental beam, which I show as a purple circle here. So you see that the RMS is order 100 microkelvin. I'm going to animate this. And you can see that along given RA DEC pointing, there's quite a bit of spectral structure. So just looking at this map, you see that there are many degrees of freedom. Oh, sorry, so this is slicing from 900 megahertz down to 700 in 256 different frequencies. So we're going out in redshift. And the key multiplier here is the omega of neutral hydrogen, which we think is something like 10 to the minus 3. It'd be great if you could go out and observe this, but at a minimum, you have detector noise. The real challenges, though, are from extragalactic and galactic synchrotron emission. When you design these sorts of experiments, obviously, you do need to worry about radio frequency interference. For the GBT in our particular band, I think we've been rather lucky, and I'd be happy to tell you about how we mask these and how we treat the RFI. The only way you can really prevent this term is by looking out of the galactic plane, and we do that by looking in four patches that overlap with the Wigglesy Galaxy Survey that has similar redshift coverage. So the data I'll tell you about are from our deep field. So this is 100 hours on a 5x3 15-hour red ascension field, and the wide field with similar amount of integration time. And these mean that you can get down to a K of about 0.1. There's a lot of heritage for analysis of this sort of data through Max Tegmark's data purifier. So I'd like to highlight in each of these steps how we think about systematics. In going from the time-ordered data to the map, we mask the RFI and handle things like calibration. And going from the map to the power spectrum, that's where we worry about subtracting most of the foregrounds. And clearly, there will be some residuals. And in the step of going to parameters, you worry about marginalizing over the effect of those residuals. So this is our real map. First of all, you'll note that the scale is plus or minus 1 Kelvin, rather than the sort of hundreds of microkelvin that you expect the signal to be. And I'll animate this. And so it looks very different than the signal. There's some structure around the edge where the survey is not as deep. That's just the thermal noise. You'll see some bands drop out, and that's where we've had to mask radio frequency interference. But you can see that for the most part, it's quite clean. But the main thing you see here is the gradient of galactic synchrotron emission and then these extragalactic sources. So the common approach to removing these very bright foregrounds in literature is to subtract some number of smooth orthogonal polynomials. And you can make this a bit more targeted by having a foreground covariance model and finding its eigenvectors. So in practice, we found that this was very difficult to pursue because of instrumental systematics that I'll say progressively more about. So what we've had to do is something completely empirically determined to find the modes to remove along these lines of sight. The idea is still that we're finding functions that we subtract out along the spectral direction. Well, so we're scanning, and we do lose a DC level, and getting feedback. And then in the mapper, we can take out a gradient, but that's the extent of it. Yep. Right, so the shift in the way to think about foregrounds is not necessarily that they're smooth, but rather that it's a limited number of functions, so that they occupy a few degrees of freedom, whereas the signal occupies many degrees of freedom. And again, those foreground degrees of freedom may not, for a real instrument, are not smooth. So technically, what you can think of doing is making a low-rank approximation to the foreground covariance. So the way we do this is, for each RA DEC pointing, we estimate the frequency-frequency covariance and then find the eigenvectors of that empirically determined covariance and remove those functions along each line of sight. And clearly, because we're removing modes determined from the map itself, we're removing some real signal, and we have to compensate for signal loss. And that's one of the most subtle aspects of, I think, generally of 21 centimeter analysis. I'd be happy to say more about that in questions. To dig into the instrumental systematics just a bit more, this is our eigenvalue spectrum, and you can see that there is one function that describes most of the covariance in the maps. And that function is the power law of synchrotron emission, but then observed by our average passband. So it's a power law with some structure. The next mode down, if you don't treat it or do anything with it, has to do with the fact that our beam size changes with frequency, and that mixes spectral structure into spatial structure. So because we're making a map, we can convolve to a common resolution and deal with that pretty effectively. And further, our side lobes are quite suppressed. Now, but as we go out further, it gets a bit harder to interpret these, and also a little bit more surprising what these terms mean. So this third piece is from polarization to intensity leakage. So at a minimum, the polarized sky will look different, so you need an additional degree of freedom if you have polarization to intensity leakage. Now, to get down to the signal, which in this space is something like 10 to the minus 6, we have to remove of order 20 modes. So the remaining sort of shelf of modes here has a less clear interpretation in terms of particular instrumental systematics, but you can guess what those might be based on the first few modes. Okay, so for example, if you have a given rotation measure in one part of the sky, that is that the polarization rotates with frequency, that gives you an oscillation in your spectrum along that line of sight, which may be different than the rotation measure along a different line of sight. So as soon as you have polarization leakage and, you know, potentially different rotation measures, you're introducing many degrees of freedom. So in general, you can think of your instrument as proliferating the rank of the foreground covariance. And further, because we're estimating these modes from the map itself, you need a good amount of signal to noise to subtract them. But the good news is that once you remove, again, of order 20 modes, you can get down to a clean map that looks like this. And again, this is going down from 900 to 700 megahertz. And you see that in the central deeper integration region, the fluctuations on the beam scale are order millikelvin. So that's starting to be at the level where you expect the signal. In case you're wondering about the edge, that's just because the integration, we haven't spent as much time scanning in that part of the survey. If you actually run the numbers, you find that this map is not a map of the neutral hydrogen density, but that and instead is mainly due to residual thermal noise, and there's not any way to get rid of that. So that just means you have to pursue a statistical detection rather than hope to make a map. Okay, the most unambiguous statistical detection you can make is by cross-correlating with an existing survey. And again, WiggleZ has good redshift coverage over our range, so we're able to find the cross-power of those two surveys. And if there are, and indeed there are, residual foregrounds underneath the thermal noise in these maps, they'll simply boost the errors on the cross-power. But the other aspect of the cross-power is that the density fluctuations traced by the galaxies may not perfectly track those of the neutral hydrogen. So generally, the cross-power is a lower limit to the 21 centimeter fluctuation power. So that is that there's a cross-correlation coefficient, or a stochasticity term, R, which is somewhere between 0 and 1. Our theoretical bias is to think that's pretty close to 1, especially on large scales. Okay, so in September, we published a 7 sigma measurement of the cross power of that clean field with the WiggleZ survey, the two fields of the WiggleZ survey. So first of all, you see there's good agreement between the two fields. In the back, you see the lambda CDM power spectral shape, and there's good agreement with that, up to an unknown amplitude. So the interesting thing you can do here scientifically is determine that amplitude, which is omega H1 BH1 times this R, which we think is fairly close to 1. And I show that down at the bottom. So there is a rather significant systematic error. That's just because it's hard to calibrate, to find an absolute calibration in these bands. OK, the main interest for 21 centimeter surveys is the auto power. That is, you don't want to depend on cross-correlating with an existing survey. And the idea here is to take the field cross itself, and you can see the challenge right away, which is that any residual foregrounds will additively bias your power spectrum. Okay, But so this measurement you can think of as being an upper bound. So you can already start to see what we might be able to do, which is use one for a lower bound and one for an upper bound. OK, so I said that the map is mainly thermal noise. And we can play a trick from the CMB to get rid of that and see a signal which is consistent with being on the sky. And the way to do that is to split the full season into four subseasons and take cross powers between different times. So say A cross B and so on. So that gives you six pairs. And further, you can take the A cross A terms and develop a Gaussian error model based on the thermal noise and develop your error bars and covariance from that. And then because we have six possible cross pairs, you get a rudimentary estimate of the error just from the standard deviation that you can compare with the Gaussian errors, and those agree quite well. This is the auto power. And starting from the top, this is the power spectrum of the input map. So you see that it's there's quite a bit of fluctuation power in the foreground. The next scales down that you see are the thermal noise in our two regions. The lower one is the deep survey, and the upper is the wide. So first of all, you see that we're measuring the foreground at huge signal to noise. Once you remove the modes I described and take the cross powers, you find the points here. OK, and then from the, and by cross power, I mean the A cross Bs. Now, from the 21 centimeter cross galaxy survey, you learn about, again, the lower bound. And you can, through the measurement of omega H1, BH1, R, you can assume R is 1, square that, and then that's the amplitude of your power spectrum. So that's this this red line. So that's the expectation of the auto power that we would have from the cross power. But again, as a lower limit. OK, so the natural thing to do is say that the signal lives somewhere between that lower limit from the cross power and the upper limit from the auto power, which could have some additive bias. So for each K bin, you can constrain the true 21 centimeter auto power to live somewhere between these two bounds. Now, this is the standard 68 and 95% confidence. So one interesting thing to point out here is that the residual foregrounds in the power spectrum are not that much larger than our error bars. So this maroon line shows, based on our error bars, what the best 95% confidence interval, upper interval you could place on the data would be. And you see that the real one, the top of this light gray one, is not so significantly different. OK, so now I'd not like to claim that that's a somewhat vacuous statement, because if somebody hands me a map and I remove all the modes, that map is identically zero. They say, well, I removed your foreground, but I also got rid of all the signal. So the way that's represented here is that the errors increase. So you can always find a place where your errors are of order, your residual foregrounds. So the salient statement here is that by the time the residual foregrounds are at the level of your errors, there's still enough signal left to work with to put a non-trivial constraint on the neutral hydrogen fluctuations. Okay, and to do that, we can combine a range of k's here. To find a posterior using both the cross power and the auto power. So in this plane, this is omega H1 BH1, if that's too small to read. The cross power gives you a lower limit, and the auto power gives you this upper limit. And then the final thing is between those. We do have to make some prior assumptions. It's not strongly dependent on those, because there's quite a bit of actual information. I'd be happy to say more about that in question. I'd like to point out that this is really a determination, not a direct measurement of the 21 centimeter fluctuations. That is, we're bounding it from two sides, but not measuring it directly. So we're clearly not measuring the BAO with this yet. This is really a pathfinder. You can already make some interesting contact with astrophysics, though, by asking what the abundance is and looking at that as a function of redshift. So existing measurements of that, I think there's a case to be made for there being systematics in each of these redshift ranges. So this is from Sloan Lehman Alpha, and this is from Hubble. So where we fit in is around redshift 1. So these are very challenging measurements that you can make currently with Hubble. And if you make a assumption, you know, the broad assumption about what the bias could be, you find that our measurements are pretty consistent. Okay, so this area is really heating up. There are a number of experiments now that are going after this low redshift, not the reionization signal. And one thing that we're working on at GBT is a multi-beam receiver. So this would not, you know, put you at the level of a Euclid-style constraint, but would just continue this sort of pathfinding idea. A similar notion is to put an array of receivers in front of a fixed dish. But the leading candidate, really, to get a cosmologically interesting constraint is to build a dedicated interferometer. And this is what Matt Dobbs will tell us about next through CHIME. The last 2 weeks have been actually quite exciting for 21 centimeter more generally. So if we just take a step back out to reionization, the best existing constraint was from GMRT. And then in the last 2 weeks, there have been new constraints, but all around the same redshift, around 8 or 9. New constraints from MWA around 300 millikelvin, and from paper at 52 millikelvin. Okay, so the expectation here is a bit different than the low redshift I had been talking about, where the fluctuations should be more like a few millikelvin. But you can see that this field is really pushing down in sensitivity. Okay, so where we stand at present is that we do have a detection of cosmological structure in 21 centimeter, and we've shown that even with some pretty complex instrumental systematics, you can suppress foregrounds to a level of order millikelvin and start to make some statements about the H1. So I'd like to say that this is a very challenging sort of measurement, and to put that in sort of a CMB context, on the one hand, it's kind of like KSE, where you have a lot of foregrounds and you like to measure this thing, which is well below those. On the other hand, it's also somehow like the B mode. So you inherit a common set of challenges. in our case, because the bright foregrounds are observed by these instrumental systematics, and you have to think about controlling those from the beginning. So if you'd like to read more about our methods for the GBT, these are both rather short papers, but I think have the full kernel of our analysis. I'd be happy to answer any questions about those afterward, too. So clearly, the longer-term goal of this is to do something like the BAO. And one thing which you hear less about is the fact that these lower redshift studies are in a very concrete regime where we know the universe very well and we can look at things in cross-correlation. So one very exciting aspect, I think, is that there'll be a transfer of methods and ideas about instruments to reionization. It's something that's already started to happen with the GMRT. Thanks, I'm happy to answer any questions.
So thanks a lot for this very interesting talk. And questions, please, now.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on why you said a real experiment has a non-smooth response to foregrounds.
Yeah, so, and this is something that is very experiment dependent, obviously. So we'll just take the case of the GBT. The way we calibrate is by looking at a bright point source, and we assume that source is spectrally smooth. But by the time we observe the real map, there can be quite a bit of spectral structure in the passband. And it's just very difficult to control that at the 10 to the 3 level. So with this eigenvector, empirical eigenvector method, that first mode absorbs that structure. Whereas if you assumed it was smooth, and fit a smooth function, you'd have all the residuals. So you have a 1% residual of a 10 to the 3 signal, and you can see where your signal's gone. Another one that's been very important at the GBT is the time stability. So the fact that we can tie two different parts of the map together. So you can imagine that if we observe the bright foregrounds along this pointing differently than we did along that pointing, you would need a different degree of freedom to describe that. So it's the imperfect absolute calibration, but also an imperfect time domain that you need additional modes for potentially.
The survey you're reporting here, is it currently ongoing? How much more time do you have? And if not, how long will it be before the multi-pixel camera is coming on?
Yeah, so right now, this is all with existing time that we've already put through. We do have two other fields that we'd like to analyze. We have a proposal in that would bring this 200 hours up to 1,000. And I think with that, you could measure redshift space distortions and start to break the bias abundance degeneracy, which is interesting, astrophysically creating the abundance and bias. The array has engineering time in July. And at that point, there'll be just a single receiver. And the idea is to measure the T-SIS. It's actually rather hard to model the T-SIS before putting a receiver there. So that'll be the main goal. And if that's promising, the idea would be to expand on that.
So there's this argument that some people, including people at Berkeley, make that in this K-parallel plane, that you have to throw away basically massive amounts, right?
Yeah.
And then that really hits your sensitivities. And I was just wondering, I mean, do you agree with those general statements, or you think there's more to be extracted?
Yeah, so I think Matt will touch on that in relation to Chime. With GBT, one interesting thing is that our side lobes are pretty far suppressed. So in the language of that wedge, there's less mode mixing. So if I don't have a plot of this, but in our case, you don't see a clear wedge in K-perp and K-parallel, which we think has to do with that suppression of the side lobes.
I guess I would think that the wedge argument, the way it's normally phrased for an interferometer, would not apply to a scanning instrument like this.
Yeah, well, I think to the extent that in this sort of scanning map domain, if you did have significant side lobes, you could have leakage which would scatter things at low K parallel up. And there are things like in our case, like the gain, which make long wavelengths which scatter long, do exactly the same thing of scattering long wavelengths up to shorter wavelength fluctuations in K parallel.
So in your eigennode decomposition, you use only the line of sight information you do that for every single line of sight.
Yeah.
You never use spatial information. You don't do full 3D eigennode decomposition. Is it something that would be interesting? Could buy you more signal?
Yeah. So Adrian Liu has done some nice work on generally where information about the foregrounds live. And so in that case, he takes the full covariance model, the three-dimensional covariance model of the foregrounds. I think there's a pretty strong argument that most of your progress is going to be in the spectral direction. And in our case, because we have to determine so much of this empirically, it helps sort of reduce the dimensionality of that. Yeah.
So assuming the cross correlation is one, right? So the lower limit really is the right limit. Then
sure.
You're still a factor of 10 off, right? I mean. At what level should I start believing your autocorrelation results as being pure 21 centimeter and not something else?
Yeah. So this is probably the relevant plot. It's a little bit hard to tell on a log scale, but on a linear scale, one of the things you can see a bit better from this is that the residual foregrounds are not hugely larger than the errors. So we can you know, take more foreground out at the expense of our errors blowing up. So you're really making this trade-off. And we think that the particular limitation that's causing a trade-off at that point for us is the fact that the survey volume is so small, the spatial area. So we're estimating the foreground covariance from a sample of, you know, okay.
So basically claiming if you had 100 times the amount of data with the same telescope, you could actually do it.
Yeah, so the thing you'd have to really control carefully, though, if you went to a larger area, you could better estimate your covariance. You'd have a larger number of samples. But you'd have to be quite careful that you haven't proliferated the number of degrees of freedom. So if you add area, if that patch needs additional degrees of freedom to describe its foregrounds, then you haven't won anything. But if you can control those systematics across the full area, you absolutely do gain in the modes you can estimate.
More questions? If that is not the case, then let's thank our speaker again for a very interesting talk. And I wish to welcome Matt Dobbs.